The lock on the door of wisdom is preconceived notions. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing here in Campbell, California, bringing you the thought for today. The lock on the door of wisdom is preconceived notions. Now, how many of you have preconceived notions about anything? How many of you have preconceived notions about life and about what goes on in this world? I had a preconceived notion this morning. I walked out the door and I looked up the valley and I heard barking. And I thought, Button wasn't in the house. Was he up the valley there chasing some friends? And I thought, surely he couldn't have been out there. So rather than going looking out in the valley, I went into the house and I saw there he was. So I knew he wasn't up the valley. But who was up the valley? Who was up the valley? Great valley that runs all the way back to the waterfall for miles and miles and miles and miles. Just land everywhere. Well, it wasn't Button. So I left my preconceived notion that it might be Button and forgot about the whole thing. It was of no consequence to me. It doesn't matter to me what goes on in the hills. It doesn't matter to me that this is bunny rabbit season and the baby bunny rabbits are everywhere and the coyotes are everywhere having breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that's not a bad thing. That's just part of life. You don't think it's bad when you have steak or Hassan Pfeffer or whatever you might have. You don't think a thing about it. You just go and eat your weenies and eat your marshmallows and eat your hamburgers and you don't realize that that was somebody a little while before, you know. Some lovely, beautiful, fantastic animal who is running around enjoying life, just having a great old time. But now it's your dinner. And yet, when you see a coyote going out after dinner, you say, that's terrible. Well, you must admit the coyote eats in the fanciest restaurant in town. He's got this great big valley just laying there, and he has a little fun before he eats. He has the chase, and then he's got to select which one he wants for his lunch. Let's see, now there's a dozen little bunnies out there. Which one's going to be my lunch? And he says, I like this fat one there, you know. He can't run as fast. But you say, Herb, that's not nice talk. Well, what makes talk nice and not nice? The butcher shop makes talk nice, and the field and the mountains and the streams, that makes talk not nice. This is what happens to us sometimes when we have our strange emotions and notions. The lock on the door of wisdom are our what? Our preconceived notions, remember? The lock on the door of wisdom is our preconceived notion. Now, what is wisdom? We look at King Solomon and the biblical story. We always think that that is the ultimate of the ultimates of the expression of wisdom, where the two women were claiming the one child. And one mother said, this is my son, Anthony. And the other one says, no, this is my son, Anthony. And so King Solomon says, you both sound like you might be the mother, you know. Now, you both deserve to have the child. And the women thought, how's he going to handle this? Going to have to live in the same house? And so King Solomon says, axeman, bring me your axe. We're going to cut the child in half, give half to one mother and half to the other mother. And of course, the wisdom of that was that the real mother would speak up. Well, what if neither one was a real mother? What if neither one really was the mother of the child? The mother of the child was somewhere else, and these two women were fighting over this child because they both wanted the child for whatever reason, and so they claimed it. And so would the child have been slaughtered for these two ne'er-do-well, not real mothers? Interesting, isn't it? You see, when you have a preconceived notion, and the preconceived notion is that a real mother will not allow her child to be killed because she needs him. She would rather see the child live and have a home somewhere rather than be put in the grave, you know. So that's not always so. That's not always so. There are many real mothers who actually kill their children. I mean, now, this really gets us way off base there, doesn't it? There are many mothers who actually do that, and we say, well, wisdom wouldn't let them do that. Well, I'm saying to you, contrary to our topic here, the lock on the door of wisdom is preconceived notions. I'm saying there is no wisdom. There is no wisdom. Wisdom is supposed to be gathered by age, gathered by experience. Wisdom is supposed to be a caringness, and yet it's not a caringness. What is wisdom? Wisdom is knowledge put to work in a given series of situations. What should we really be looking for? What should we really be looking for in our life? What would our thought for today really encourage us to do? It would encourage us to say, I am the master. I am the master. I speak my word at all times, and I bring about the results at all times. I speak my word at all times, and I bring about the results at all times. This morning I was walking the path. It was about 1:30, 2 o'clock. And I was thinking to myself, I would like to have a good symbol for the University of Philosophy. And then I thought, what would be the most proper symbol for the University of Philosophy? I said, what is the University of Philosophy? Well, the University of Philosophy is the story of absolute. It's the story of man's coming aware of what absolute means and how everything is absolute. And that absolute is the allness, the isness, the all these things. Absolute is you might say, education, or illumination, or inspiration. And then the word illumination kept coming up, as you had all talked about it a little bit yesterday, saying that a good symbol for absolute would be light, you know, something that would be radiant in knowledge and awareness. And I thought, what does the University of Philosophy teach? The University of Philosophy teaches absolute. It teaches the relative absolute, and the absolute in those three sections. Now, I had said, all right, we'll have degrees for the University of Philosophy, and we were trying to change them from what we had before, because the state has said that if you're not fully an academic university, you can't use the University of Philosophy. You cannot use the Bachelor Bachelor of Philosophy, Master of Philosophy, and the PhD, Doctor of Philosophy. You have to have a different term. So it doesn't indicate that you are an academic university, you know. We are a non-academic university. So I thought, well, now what would we do? So I changed it to the Bachelor of Spiritual Philosophy. Now, certainly no one would presume that spiritual philosophy was an academic philosophy, although it is more academic than the academic philosophy is. It is far deeper than any one day this philosophy will be considered, perhaps, to be the ultimate of academic understanding, you know. And but that's all in its due time, and we are not really concerned. We just do our thing and enjoy it. I don't think Socrates was worried about what his school was called and what the certificates were that he didn't hand out. and things like that. He just created people who were able to think for themselves. So, in the University of Philosophy, what would be a good symbol? What would be a good degree? And I thought the Doctor of Spiritual Philosophy was a good one. And then this morning I thought, no, that really isn't it. Because we're not teaching spiritual things. Spiritual things need to have a God. They need to have things that go with the word spiritual. And in truth, we're not going with any word spiritual. We're going with the word absolute. We're going with a word that transcends the transcending word itself. And so perhaps the best term for the degree for the University of Philosophy is the Bachelor of Absolute and the Master of Absolute.
Absolute Philosophy.
And the Doctor of Absolute. Absolute Philosophy. Well, you don't even need the word philosophy. Philosophy would be okay too. Absolute philosophy, that's an idea. I hadn't thought of that. Bachelor of Absolute Philosophy.
That's
now, that really touches home, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Bachelor of Absolute Philosophy. It says exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then, that would be B-A-P, BAP, and B-S-P, and B, D, M-S-P, and D-S-P. So that's okay too. But then the state allows you to have five degree symbols with it each. So I thought we would add the other degree of master, pure and simple, just master. And the other one, what did I say? Something similar. But, like illuminato, illumination, the degree of illumination when you reach this level of awareness. I think the Rosicrucians have desired to think in that direction, and the Summit Lighthouse people and other organizations have all sought to work in the area of illumination. And illumination is a very significant concept or word, and I haven't fully developed what that will be yet, but it's an interesting thought. Now, what would wisdom say to you to do under these circumstances? Wisdom would say, don't affiliate yourself with the state. Just stay an outside, independent, non-recognized organization just by the church itself, and take the Bachelor of Philosophy and the Master of Philosophy and Doctor of Philosophy, because that is what you have wanted to do and have been doing all these many years. Now, then I thought, no, it's so much nicer to be able to go cooperatively along with the state and have the state say, giving that degree is okay. They don't approve it or disapprove it. They just say it's okay. It's not contrary to our rules. And all they can rule on are academic universities, you know. So rather than going contrary to the state, which I wasn't doing, but rather than going contrary to the state, to harmoniously go along with it. Wisdom is harmoniously flowing with life. And I thought that was an interesting idea. Wisdom is when you are harmoniously flowing with life. You are not in contradistinction to life. You are not trying to push something through to be something that you'd like to be, but you haven't earned the right to be. And I don't know that we ever want to earn the right to be an academic university, because an academic university teaches the physical sciences. It teaches the physical arts. It teaches mathematics and chemistry and all these other good things, business knowledge and stuff like that. And this is a field which transcends any of that. It is a metaphysical field. And we are in the metaphysical field beyond the physical, because that is where we are. And that is what we teach, and that's what we do. So it's so easy to somehow get caught up with wanting to have what everybody else has. I was thinking, some people like to run around naked. And when they do this, they're going contrary to the rest of the world. Because the rest of the world teaches that you should be properly dressed and for different occasions. When you're at the beach, you wear your swimming clothes, and when you're at the dancing party, you wear your dancing clothes, and when you're doing whatever, you dress accordingly. But then when you are in a nudist camp, then you don't have to wear clothes. That is not expected of you there. So I thought, hey, rather than being contrary to the world, we'll just have the world be one great big school where we teach the absolute philosophy. We'll have the world, if we want to go naked, be a nudist camp. The entire world will be a nudist camp where everybody goes naked, where that's just what you do. And nobody would think a thing about it. You wouldn't think that there is any sexual overtones or anything else there. It's just that people are wearing the lovely clothes. When these girls wear these rather fetching clothes in the bar room or the dance hall or something, you think, well, you know, they're, you know, out to have a sexual experience. And perhaps they're just out to have fun. Perhaps this is their way of letting their hair down and being themselves and yet not saying yes. You understand? You don't have to say yes because you wear sexy clothes. Remember Elvis Presley? Mm-hmm. How did he sing? He gyrated like some horny dog, you know, that was trying to, you know, be sexual. And yet he wasn't. He wasn't. And everything he did was sort of compelling, that the girls loved him. The guys loved him, and the guys had no interest in him sexually. And the girls, they may have had an interest in him sexually, but really what their interest was in his musical presentations. He was very good, but he was not great. He was not a great singer. He was a good singer, but he was not a great singer. You might say Maria Lanza, Anzio Pinza, you might say the great operatic singers and so forth were great, but the daily singers, if you can say that, the singers on the radio and television, they're just good, like Vic Damone, you know, and a few of the others that we remember. What's their names? Schnell.
The Beatles.
Yeah, sure, the Beatles. Yeah, the Beatles. And the Beatles will live on forever as some of the most magnificent singers the world has ever heard, right? But Sinatra, Frank Sinatra, you remember him?
Yeah.
Remember him?
Tony
and
Bennett.
And yeah. Bing Crosby, you know.
Oh, yeah, Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah, and Ella Fitzgerald. Yeah, a few women there, too. But you see, they're good.
Sara Leander also.
They're good, but they're not great. Who did you say?
Sara Leander. That's a German.
Oh, yeah, well, that's not fair to use that here, because that person is not known in America. But these American people are known all over the world because of the movies. And perhaps this person you're speaking about was in the movies, too. What?
Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, we don't need more names, but yeah, that's right, Barbara Streisand. But these are a lot of people, and if you were going to the theater to listen to someone sing, would you go to hear Barbara Streisand? No. She is not a compelling voice. But using it along with her acting experience, along with the way in which it's used in context, it's very charming. It's very charming. And a lot of these other people, they're very charming. And but great? No. So how are we going to relate ourselves to greatness, to wisdom? How are we going to relate ourselves to unlocking that door to the wisdom within us? Well, in the first place, The wisdom within us says, let's see now. Pavarotti is a great singer, but I wouldn't like to listen to him all day long. Vic Damone is a great singer. I could listen to him night and day. Now, what's the difference? Pavarotti sings songs in various languages you don't understand. Pavarotti sings the traditional operatic songs, which are usually pretty heavy-duty stuff, and they display his vocal talent, but they don't make you feel warm and cozy when you're done. When you hear Vic Damone or Frank Sinatra or any of these other wonderful singers, and Bing Crosby and so on, you just feel a warmth in your heart about it. You just feel an overflowing of love as you hear them sing, because they are giving something of their heart. And Pavarotti truly is giving something of his heart, but he's giving something of his heart that is not something that people listen to all day long. You understand?
One could follow, imitate in some way.
Yeah. The thing is, what we want to do is, yes, we want to be able to imitate it. And we cannot imitate a Pavarotti, but we can imitate a Vic Damone. We can imitate a Bing Crosby. We can imitate a Ella Fitzgerald and many of these others who sing the popular songs. Now, let's take this a step further, too. Will Vic Damone be remembered 200 or 300 years from now? Will Pavarotti be remembered 200 or 300 years from now? Pavarotti will be remembered because he did the classics. And even though I don't remember the names of many of these old singers from 50, 100 years ago, if I mentioned their name, instantly you'd remember them because they sang the classics. If they had sung on the radio, if they had radio, if they had sung on the radio and television, they wouldn't be remembered, primarily because they sang for a season. What makes Mozart's music great? Beethoven, Bach. What makes their music traditional, standing down through the ages? If people didn't want to hear it, it could not be great. If people didn't want to listen to it, it would not become classical, it would not become universal. But because people do want to listen to it, it becomes universal. Now, I am sure that there are many wonderful bedroom singers in the days of yesterday, and they are on records, and they are on whatever media could be on. And we don't hear them, we don't know them, because the songs are not popular to us. I was through the 40s and 50s, and the songs of the 40s and 50s are very charming to me, and they bring back wonderful memories. But the songs of the 30s, the 20s and 30s, were my mother and father's time. They made them feel good, but it didn't turn me on particularly. And the songs of the 1900 and 1910s, I don't even know what the songs were, and they don't carry through. And the songs of the 50s and 60s, with your Beatles and your White Submarine and so forth, I have no interest in it whatsoever. And I'm sure it's the generation, and the music stands with them. Well, now, wisdom is the same way. Wisdom is the same way. When wisdom is based upon universal aspects, universal principles, then it is forever a benefit. We will always be able to say the wisdom of Solomon, cutting a child in two, because the two ladies said it was their son. No one will ever forget that. Even though it's a Bible story, and certainly other religious groups who are not Christian and would not take that, you know, but that's really Old Testament, it's Hebrew, and they would not be aware of that, but yet that story is universally true. And have any of you ever read any of the Sufi stories? The Sufi stories are quite delightful and charming, and they're universal. And yet they're out of another religious culture. They're out of another religious culture. And still they're beautiful. Now, you take many of the Jewish parables and stories, and they are so unique to their philosophy that they're not of a universal nature. And some of them are kind of charming, like when you hear the story of the fiddler on the roof, you know. And he asks his wife, "Do you love me?" And his wife says, "Get out of here. You bother me." No. She says, "Do I cook your food? But do you love me? Well, do I raise your children? Do I iron your clothes? Do I take care of the house? But do you love me?" And, you know, he wanted to get down to the basics of, do you love me? Now, that is a universal, charming concept. It's not one that a normal family would think of saying, you know, but it was one that they, who practiced the art of having someone else select your mate for you, where you didn't choose by love your own person to marry, the question, do you love me, is quite proper. He asked it that time. Now, do you love yourself? Do you love yourself sufficiently to do anything that makes you happy? Do you love yourself sufficiently to make any choice that's going to bring you into a world of fulfillment for yourself? Do you? Now, if you do, then you don't argue with anybody else about it. You don't explain it to anybody else. You just go and do your thing. And this morning, Sylvia put a note on the door, which should have been typed, because it's much easier to read. And the note began, "Please." And I had just talked with you all yesterday about the word please. When you are a boss in charge, if you say please to your employees, it means they have the opportunity to not do as you ask. When you say to your employees, do this and do that and do this and do that, then there's no discussion. And there's no discussion, am I going to do it in this rotation or that? So we want to like ourselves so much that we can give orders, if such is our calling, and not feel that we have to make people like us because we don't like ourselves. When we like ourselves, we can give orders, we can go out and be silly. I read you a thing on that a little bit ago, and it said, I don't know, it might even be here. Yeah, here it is. "Starting now, I live my life new. I dare to take more chances. I relax. I limber up. I am sillier. I climb more mountains and swim more rivers. I eat more ice cream. I have more so-called troubles, but I have fewer imaginary troubles. I travel light. I go barefoot earlier in each spring, and I stay that way as long as possible. I find fun in life and smell the flowers. I am here to be myself and have fun starting now." The lock of the door of wisdom is preconceived notions. And that's what we do sometimes. We have preconceived notions. And the preconceived notions keep us from enjoying smelling the flowers. So this day, I would bless each one of you with going out and smelling the flowers, going out and being creative, going out and doing something different than you ever did before, and yet doing the same things you did before, but doing them with a lot more enjoyment, with love and peace in your heart. And do it because you're wonderful, and I believe in you. I love you. I love you. I love you.